Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 13. We will do verses 1 through 28, the entire chapter today. We will call this Job Continues, Responding to Zophar. Still, I will hope in God. Our context is this. Job has just endured speeches from his three false friends, Eliphaz in chapter 4 and 5, Bildad in chapter 8, and Zophar in chapter 11 and 12. And basically, these three friends are telling Job, hey, you're guilty. You did something to deserve this. And Job answers them. For example, in chapter 6 and 7, he answers Eliphaz, and he says, my complaint is just. I haven't done anything. And then in Job 9, Job replies to Bildad the Shuhite, and he says, there's no arbiter for me. God is not listening to my case, even though I know I haven't done anything right. And so Job is beginning to complain. And then Zophar has spoken in chapters 11 and 12, or actually in chapter 11, and Zophar piled it on Job. He said, you deserve worse, Job, than what you've already gotten. And Job, in the last chapter, replied to Zophar and said, look, the Lord has done this. I done what? Well, probably referring to Zophar's claim that God is mighty, he's majestic, he's just, he creates justice and so forth. And Job is saying, I agree with you, Zophar, but you still haven't explained to me why I am suffering for something I didn't do. And so Job in chapter 13, the last chapter, he continues and says to Zophar, as he answers his three false friends, he says, still, I will hope in God. Job has not denied God's justice or holiness. Job has not let loose of his integrity. He has maintained his integrity before God, even though he is complaining. He's complaining because he can't get a hearing for his particular case, but in general, he knows God to be just, and he's not going to deny that. And he carries on in the same line in this chapter, chapter 13, as Job continues responding to Zophar, look, I'm still going to hope in God despite my miserable condition. So we start now at Job 13, 1 through 5. Job says this to Zophar, behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. Seen what? Well, that would be the power, the majesty, the wisdom, and justice of God that Zophar went on and on about in chapter 11, and which, of course, Job is not arguing about. And so Job concedes, look, Zophar, I've seen all that. My ear has heard and understood it. How does Job know all about God's power, majesty, wisdom, and justice? Well, he heard all about it from Zophar and his two friends. Maybe that's what Job is referring to when he says he's heard all this. Or maybe he just means from God, I've heard that he's a just God, or from ancient wisdom passed down from generation to generation. But Job knows who God is. Verse 2, what you know, Job says, I also know. I am not inferior to you. Job said the same thing in the last chapter, verse 3, chapter 12. But I have intelligence as well as you. I am not inferior to you. And who does not know such things as these? In other words, everybody knows that God has power, majesty, wisdom, and justice. That's not the question. That doesn't answer my problem. Why is this God of justice and wisdom doing this to me when I haven't done anything to deserve it? Verse 3, Job says, but I would speak to the Almighty. I desire to argue with God. Now, that argue is used in a judicial sense, a legal argument. He wants to speak to Almighty even as a plaintiff would go into a courtroom and say, I want some justice, God. I'm not getting any justice from my friends here. I'd like some justice from the Almighty. Verse 4, but Job contrasts his friends with God. You smear with lies. God doesn't do that. You are all worthless physicians, physicians who wants to heal Job's misery, and all you do is make it worse. Job's in a passion now. He says, you smear with lies. Now, that could mean premeditated lies, and that would be pretty harsh for Job to say because, as John Gill points out, because it doesn't seem to me that Job's friends were deliberately lying. They were just mistaken. They thought that if a bad thing happened to a good person, the person wasn't good, he was actually bad. They were wrong about that, but I don't think they were deliberately lying to Job. But Job says they're liars. Well, that word could mean error spoken from ignorance and mistake and not premeditation and intent, deliberate intent. Either way, they're worthless physicians. And Job says in verse 5, oh, that you would be completely silent. That reminds one of Proverbs 17, verse 28. Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent. Job's false friends would have done real well if they had just kept their mouths shut instead of making things worse and worse and worse. Job says, your silence would become your wisdom. The NIV says, if only you would be altogether silent, for you, that would be wisdom. In other words, shut up. Job 13, verses 6 through 7, Job continues speaking to Zophar. Actually, he's responded not only to Zophar, but to Eliphaz and Bildad, because he says, you are all worthless physicians in verse 4. So he continues in verse 6, please hear my argument and listen to the contentions of my lips. Will you speak what is unjust for God and speak what is deceitful for him? Please hear my argument. That's a legal argument, a forensic term, as Adam Clark points out. In fact, most of the terms that we're going to see in this controversy here refer to legal proceedings. Job is asking for his day in court with God. Verse 7, Job says, will you, i.e. my false friends, speak what is unjust for God? The false friends were arguing for God's justice, but they were unjustly accusing Job in doing so, in making those arguments, and so that's unjust because it's an argument based on a lie. Will you speak what is deceitful for him? You're telling God that I have done something to deserve this? Well, that's deceitful. That's not true. If you say that I've sinned before God, you're saying that Job is a bad man. You're saying that I, Job, am a hypocrite, and that's just not true. That's deceitful. Are you going to speak something deceitful to God, to my judge? We go now to Job 13, verses 8 through 12. Job continues, will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well when he examines you? Or will you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely reprove you if you secretly show partiality. Will not his majesty terrify you, and the dread of him fall on you? Your memorable sayings are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. In verse 8, Job says, hey, false friends, you going to show partiality for God? In other words, are you going to slant the case against me by not telling the truth to God? Remember, God is a just God. He is much more than a human judge. He is God, and he's going to come after you. He will surely reprove you if you secretly show partiality against me. So Job is setting up this as a contest between his false friend's view of the situation and his view of the situation. Now, the false friends only operated halfway. They pointed out that God was holy, as I've pointed out in previous chapters. Yeah, they say that God's holy, but the problem is they didn't also point out that Job was a righteous man, as God himself said in chapter 1. He did not sin at all. He did not sin with his lips. In verse 9, Job says, will it be well with you false friends when God examines you? Well, actually, God did examine the false friends later on, and they didn't come out so good. As John Gill says, later on, when God gave judgment against the false friends, and when he declared that they had not said that which was right, as his servant Job had, well, then it will not go well with them. In fact, we see that in Job 42, verse 7. It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Oh, get chastised by the judge. And Job was right about that. He's saying, hey, false friends, you better be careful what you're saying because your time's coming. Your memorable sayings will be proverbs of ashes. In other words, a proverbs that will not give joy but will give grief, because ashes are a symbol of grief. Your defenses are defenses of clay, because clay is soft and it breaks very easy. We go now to Job 13, verses 13 through 19. Job continues, be quiet, and I will speak. Let whatever comes happen to me. Why do I put myself at risk and take my life in my own hands? Even if he kills me, I will hope in him. I will still defend my ways before him. Yes, this will result in my deliverance, for no godless person can appear before him. Pay close attention to my words. Let my declaration ring in your ears. Now then, I have prepared my case. I know that I am right. Can anyone indict me? If so, I will be silent and die. Now Job is saying in verse 14, he puts his life at risk in his own hands by trying to contend with God and get a case with him in court, in God's courtroom. And why is that? Well, because you contend with God in a lawsuit and you lose. Well, then God could actually punish Job more if Job's found guilty. But Job is not worried about being found guilty. He knows he's innocent, so he says, hey, I'm telling you why I'm putting myself at risk and taking my life in my own hands, because even if he kills me, I will hope in him. I trust his justice. I will still defend my ways before him. I trust that I am innocent. I will defend my ways before him means I am not going to confess to a sin I did not commit. And God will deliver me. Verse 16, this will result in my deliverance, my salvation, as some translations have it. For no godless person can appear before him, and I am not a godless person. I am a righteous person, and God will deliver me. So you can chastise me all you want, my three false friends, but I'm going to trust in God. Even if he kills me, which I don't believe he will, but even in that extreme case, I would still hope in him. Verse 14 says, why do I put myself at risk and take my life in my own hands? Other translations have, why do I take my flesh in my teeth? That's New American Standard Bible. The NIV says, why do I take my life in my hands? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown concurs with that, and I think that's the way we should translate it. Adam Clark says that Job is saying, why do I bite my lips? In other words, Job is saying, I'm not going to restrain from speaking. I'm going to tell the truth here. No, I think it's better to take it. Why do I take my life in my own hands? Because Job is concerned that, or he's actually making a statement that if he dares to go before God, he could end up getting killed by God's justice. But he is so confident that he has done nothing wrong, that he is not a godless person appearing before God, that nothing's going to happen to him. He, in fact, will be delivered. So Job says, pay close attention to my words. Now, Job is talking to Zophar and the two friends right now. He's not talking to God. He says, let my declaration ring in your ears. I'm innocent, guys. Now then, I've prepared my case. Once again, case is legal terminology, my law case. Can anyone indict me? Ooh, another legal term. That's a criminal justice term. The state prepares an indictment saying what the accused is accused of. And Job's saying, hey, nobody's going to indict me. I didn't do anything wrong. If I did do something wrong, I'll shut up and die, but I didn't do anything wrong. I want my day in court with God. We go now to verses 20 and 21 of Job 13. Job turns back to speaking to God now, not the false friends. He says in verse 20, only two things do not do to me, then I will not hide from your face. Verse 21, here's the first thing, don't remove your hand from me. And here's the second thing, do not let the dread of you terrify me. Do not let your dread terrify me. Those two things seem to be about the same thing to me. Remove your hand from me means quit caring about me. Just ignore me. Don't do that to me. And then when that happens, of course, I'm going to be scared to death of you, God, that you're going to have abandoned me. He says, I'll listen to what you have to say about my alleged sin, but please do not abandon me and leave me alone. Job knew God personally. It's obvious he did. Now, Job's requests were not immediately granted by God, as the NIV Study Bible points out. God did remove his hand, at least his perceptual hand. It didn't seem to Job like God was still around anymore, and he was afraid of God. The dread of God did terrify him, but that changed when we get to the end of the book. God's presence came back on Job, and God took God's terror away from Job and comforted him at the end of the book. But despite the fact that Job was feeling abandoned by God and terrified of God, Job nevertheless pursues his case against God here. He implies that he's not going to pursue his case with God because if God hides his face, but he did anyway. Job actually had earlier requested this from God in Job 9, verse 34, let him, i.e. Yahweh, let Yahweh remove his rod from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Psalms 39 says the same thing. This is David, a Davidic psalm. Remove your plague from me. Because of the opposition of your hand, I am perishing. Boy, there's nothing worse when you feel like God's against you. God, I pray this, and I keep getting kicked in the teeth. That's when you got to grit your teeth and hold on, because God will bring you justice. It's just a matter of time and endurance. But at any rate, Job here feels like it's hard to make his legal arguments to God when he's in a state of pain. So he's saying, God, please don't leave me here while I'm doing this. We go to Job 13, verses 22 through 28, and we'll finish this chapter. Job says to God, then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, then reply to me. Now, what he's saying here is, you can be the petitioner, God. Let's say it's a civil lawsuit. God is the plaintiff. Then call or petition me or summon me. The legal term is summon. So give me a summons and I will answer. That's also a legal term. Or let's turn it around. Let me speak. Let me be the plaintiff and then you reply to me. I don't care. Job is saying he will be either plaintiff or defendant. God's choice, as John Gill points out. Well, Job immediately decides to be the plaintiff. He doesn't wait for God to respond. He just says, I'll be the plaintiff. Verse 23, how many are my iniquities and sin? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. In other words, he's complaining to God now legally, and he wants God to answer him. John Gill says this is very boldly said indeed and seems to savor of irreverence towards God. John Gill further says this may be one of those speeches for which Job was blamed by Elihu and by the Lord himself. This is later on in the chapter when God's going to chastise Job for being a little whiny. But as John Gill points out, Job is not intending to be irreverent here. He was passionate to vindicate himself, and he was in a lot of pain. So he's not being irreverent. He's being passionate. And of course, the application here is when things are going bad, you've got every right. God wants you to come to him and say, dear God, what is going on? Please help me. I don't understand. In verse 23, Job is basically saying, God, prove it. How many are my iniquities and sins? Prove it. Prove to me that you are a just God. He's getting quite bold with God. And again, our application for today, we need to be bold with God when we don't understand what's going on. Verse 25, will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? A little tiny leaf blowing in the wind, trembling. That's what Job is. What does God care about Job? Why do you need to torture me so? I'm not hurting your kingdom. I'm not messing up the workings of the universe. I'm just a nothing burger, so why do you take so much time to make my life miserable? Will you pursue the dry chaff, Job says to God? Chaff, of course, is the stuff that the grains of wheat are contained in that you throw up in the air with a winnowing fork and the chaff gets blown away by the wind. It's worthless for eating, and of course it's dry when you do that, and so the wind carries it away, and so it's worthless, non-substantial, and so Job says, well, that's what I am. I'm worthless and non-substantial in your eyes, so why are you doing this? Why are you spending so much time to write bitter things against me? As in an indictment, a legal indictment. Write it down, Job, you did this, Job, you did that. What's going on here, God? Why are you making me inherit the iniquities of my youth? In verse 26, Job is thinking, look, I've already been forgiven for what I did in my sinful youth, but now it seems to me that God might be bringing those things up again. It seems that God had not indeed forgiven Job for the sins of his youth. Job was probably thinking that God had forgotten all the good things of his life and just picked out the bad ones. And Job probably thought it was unfair to make such a fuss over his youthful recklessness when he's lived a righteous and blameless life ever since his youth. Verse 27, Job says, you put my feet in the stocks. You watch all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. In other words, wherever I go, you're tracking me and I can't move. But first of all, my feet are in the stocks. I can't even walk. Or if I do walk, you watch wherever I go. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. That's probably because his feet are in the stocks. Now, there's a translation issue here. You set a limit for the soles of my feet, Job says. Well, there are other translations. For example, the KJV says, thou settest a print upon the heels of my feet. The NIV says, you keep close watch on all my paths by putting marks on the soles of my feet. So those two translations have marks on Job's feet. What might that mean? John Gill suggests the stocks, themselves made marks on the soles of Job's feet, thus marking him as a criminal. Or it could be an allusion to heavy blows received by criminals on the soles of their feet with the bastinado, that club that penal torturers would use to bash the bottom of your feet, which was extraordinarily painful. And once that happened, you couldn't walk, you couldn't flee because you're crippled. And so that might be what Job is saying. You've put marks on my feet with the bastinado. NIV Study Bible suggests that ancient slave owners branded their slaves' names on their feet, or branded the slave owner's name on their feet to show that they were slaves, those who were in the stocks, and so they couldn't run off and do whatever they wanted to do. And so the whole point of this, whatever it means, is that Job is constrained, he's limited, he's not free anymore. In verse 28, he says, while I am decaying like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten, his life is just getting eaten up. So Job is complaining, but now he's asking for some justice from God, and he still maintains his hope in God. So now we have finished Job chapter 13. We are now prepared to go to Job chapter 14, verses 1 through 22. Job continues, and he says, death soon comes to all. I hope you stay tuned for Job's speech in our next chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this one.